G'day, Jim. Honour and privilege to be with you today. So, as you may be aware, I'm running for the Upper House of Western Victoria. We're getting on to you because one of our major key things we've been looking at is trying to protect small businesses and family-owned businesses. Most of the stuff I've been doing at the moment has been getting out and seeing farms and that sort of thing, which is family business there and small business. But there are obviously lots of people that do other small businesses, such as yourself. So that's why it'd be great to get your point of view on everything that's been going on. You mentioned just before from 2000, what would have happened if we'd had different people in 2000? Like what change happened?
What happened was that Daniel Andrews was able to steamroll the entire state, and then the upper house was a bit of wet lettuce. They didn't resist him in any way, even when he made the most outrageous claims for authority. He just basically bribed and intimidated the upper house to support him. If we'd have had, even if Labor had been controlled of the lower house, if the upper house had had some gumption and we had to stand up to him, he couldn't have done what he did, and it wouldn't have been nearly as bad as what it was.
Right. So what sort of stuff did he bring in? What sort of stuff did he bring in 2000 that's led to the downfall? Because it obviously doesn't happen overnight. The same as the pandemic things. It started off, you know, and then it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, it was the form of the lockdown. It was just insane. There was no justice. There was no sense in what he did. He stopped sole operators from working. You know, independent contractors who clean pools, build fences, mow lawns, whatever. Even with no contact with the public, they weren't allowed to work. Whereas council gardeners could work even in groups, doing the same jobs. It made no sense in terms of health. It made every sense politically, because of course Daniel Andrews is supported by the unions, whereas of course small business don't tend to vote Labor for very good reason, as we proved during the event. But it's even more insane, and you can see the effect of the upper house. There was the following year, 2021, there was another lockdown. Now in this case, it actually locked down individual dog washing people, but the salons were open. So here's a health measure. If somebody comes to your house alone, doesn't touch you, doesn't go anywhere near you, just takes over the dog and washes the dog, that's apparently a huge danger to health. However, if you go to a salon where you're in touch with dozens of different people in public, that's allowed. Now that made no sense at all, except if you understand the politics that the so-called Animal Justice House, a party representing the dog grooming salons, Andrews needed their support. So he made a decision which was completely ludicrous and unfair from a health point of view, but totally understandable in terms of politics. But if that person had had some credibility and some decency and stuck up for the dog grooming industry as a whole instead of for narrow constituents, then he would have been harder to do what he did.
Is this a problem you see with a lot of minor parties that come in that have a single-minded focus? Like if you, for example, if you've only got one topic that you're running on, then it's pretty easy to get one thing done for you, but it comes at the expense of everything else. Is that
a
likely statement?
I had a whole lot of special interest groups in the upper house, obviously, and he just brought them up one by one with different kinds of measures. Yeah. There were people who stood up to him, but unfortunately not enough of them. Obviously, the Liberal Party did what they could to support small business, but they just had no power, and he could cozen them. I mean, the government has a lot of authority. They can actually do all kinds of things to get their way. So, and they can dole out favours and political favours and advantages and money and all kinds of things to actually buy people around. So if you've got people who've got no principles and just very narrow in their focus, they can be steamrolled. It wasn't even a close thing, actually. He just had total control. Nobody could stand up to him. The only opposition to Daniel Andrews during the lockdown was, in fact, the press. And even then, it was only the Murdoch press. The ABC was as spineless as anything. They just went along with whatever he wanted. You know, Daniel Andrews is our god. We represent the 10% of Australians who are all inner city greenies, so that's all we care about.
So you would have reached out to a few politicians. Did any of them actually get back to you and sound like they were trying to help you out?
Oh, yes. I had frequent contact with Liberal Party politicians during that time. They were very helpful, beneficial. There was a federal senator I spoke to. I know a certain number of Liberal MPs.
So were they actively trying to help you out and they just couldn't do anything?
Yeah. Well, they were on side, all right. They understood the damage to small business and they were as outraged as I. They just didn't have any power to do anything.
Yeah.
Because the Daniel Andrews machine is so powerful in Victorian politics. It's a horrible thing to say. I can't say I ever worried too much about state politics in the past, more focused on federal. But when you see how a incompetent and ideologically driven and politically partial leader can do such damage to the state. I mean, let's face it, what happened is we had the worst lockdown of any city in the world. And the damage that was done was done not by lawman contractors going out mowing lawns. It was done by Daniel Andrews stuffing up quarantine with total incompetence. It was incredibly bad. You had to look at other states where they had much more reasonable, like New South Wales, for example, had much more reasonable measures to control infection. Without the terrible damage to livelihood that Andrews put us all through, they had the same infection rates. I mean, no more people died in New South Wales than they did in Victoria. So you had a competent, reasonably competent government doing reasonably sensible things to guard public health. And I was always in support of reasonable things. Now, we didn't go to church for 2 years. I wasn't happy about that, but I understood the reason. You can't go out to have a meal. I understand the reason for that. But the way that the Andrews government acted was just had no sense. They didn't protect public health. What he did is protect his own personal political situation, and that's all he cared about. The Andrews government, as you know, does incessant focus groups. They're really strong on social media. They're always looking at what people want, and they know how to steer the message, and they can buy off their special interest and do things like that. It's a political machine. It's brilliant. He's a brilliantly competent leader of a political movement. He's just a brilliantly incompetent leader of a society in crisis.
I think he's been, a lot of people I've spoken to, as much as they don't like him, they have to give him props for what he's been able to do with how much he's been able to control everything the way he's wanted to.
Yeah.
That's never been a question.
Politically, he's a very clever man. No question about it. It's just that if you want somebody to stand on principle rather than politics, you're looking in the wrong place if you're looking to Daniel Andrews. I mean, here's an example, the daily news conferences that he did. That was all worked out because of very careful polling of the public. That's what the public wanted. They wanted somebody up front and talking about it. Now, so much of what he said was rubbish, but that didn't matter. It just did well politically. He's a great political operator. I will give him that credit. He's just a lousy, lousy premier.
I think the big difference I found between New South Wales and Victoria at the time was just the reporting on the statistics. Like they'd say who was in hospital with this and how many were in ICU and that. Whereas at the time, we were just getting how many case numbers it was and saying it was going, everything was done. The world was coming to an end. There was no, and again, we still don't have any health advice. So that's another issue that we're still managing to have to push through, and I doubt we will get any health advice until after the election if Dan gets out. If he gets back in again, I dare say there's a good chance we still won't see any health advice as much as we have a new committee made up and that sort of thing.
Look, the story we got was absurd. For example, I don't know if people realise that, but the death rate in Australia actually dropped during COVID. We had less people dying than you normally would. It wasn't a public health disaster. Also, the average age of death from COVID is higher than the standard life expectancy of the population of birth. And I'm not saying we did the wrong thing in cutting off overseas travel. I mean, the federal government particularly did a brilliant job and they did it very fast. There's much criticism. They said, we're cutting it off. And they kept the disease out for a long time until vaccinations were possible. So in many ways, we handled it very well. But the state government is appallingly bad. The public health of the system of the state government is awful. You know, if you were to judge based on, you know, you look at the people that Daniel Andrews employs, he has a host of people like in diversity consultants, you know, racial bias people, all kinds of people who get the right balance of political in every stage of the thing. He's very good at that. He's got legions of highly paid consultants working on those kinds of areas. Now, to do that, you've got to skimp in some areas. So what he did is skimp on politically unimportant areas like public health, for example. So the public health system in Victoria was completely inadequate to the task. But you can't do both You can't put all your energy into politics, especially left-wing identitarian politics, and also look after the health population. You've got to make a choice. And Andrew's made his choice. He said, no, politics matters most to me. Health, definitely down the track a bit, much less important. If we've got any money left over, we'll look at the health of the public. But first of all, let's guide ourselves politically.
Yeah, last I heard, he had 90.
No question. He's very clever at what he does.
I think last I heard, he had 90 staffers. I'm like, so, I mean, it might not even be so much about how clever he is, but he's got a lot of good people working for him. So that's, yeah, you got to pay that.
That's part of it. I'm a total idiot in most ways, but I got great staff. So they compensate for my inadequacies. I can't criticize him for that.
To jump out of politics for a minute. So wondering, you've obviously gone from being a, you started as just a one man pushing his own mowing to being basically one of the largest companies we have in Australia. Are you in, how many franchises do you have now?
40 something, yeah.
Yeah, I think last I had a look, it was about 4,300. I was just wondering, have you gone backwards since the Dan Andrews thing? Did people have to
We've just passed 4,800. We've actually grown dramatically. We'll probably hit 5,000 fairly soon. We've had a tremendous year.
This year?
Yes. Oh, it's been one of the best years ever, which is really interesting because it's actually, our problem is we've got far too much work and not enough franchisees. We've got nearly 40% of our leads are unserviced so far this year, which is extraordinary. We just can't grow fast enough to take up the demand from the public. So in actual fact, usually we do better in times of recession. Like back in the early 90s in the Keating recession, we actually grew by 40% in a single year from 1,000 to 1,400. And that was because people were losing their jobs. We've now got the tightest labor market in my lifetime, with the lowest unemployment and the most demand for work. So we should be actually probably going backwards. We're actually, in fact, we're growing quite fast.
I think the unemployment thing's a bit skewed at the moment when you have a look at the amount of people that are still like getting funds from the government, so they're not actively looking, which means you don't count as unemployed. So I think
it's possibly the reason. I can tell you, as an employer, it's very, very hard to get workers. We're desperately struggling because of the sheer volume of calls coming to our call centre. We're struggling like mad to try and find call centre operators. We're doing everything possible. People can work from home, from other states, all kinds of things, just to try and get enough. Mm. It's very, very difficult to find staff. And our franchisees are crying out for staff. I mean, we could have thousands of jobs to people in doing things like our lawn mowing and cleaning and pest control and all the rest of it, building fences, if we had quality staff to do them. Desperate shortage of staff, but still we've managed to grow in franchise numbers. And I must say that the one of the reasons we're probably doing so well is thanks to the Premier, because the publicity and the public exposure we got over this whole thing has actually lifted the profile of the company to an extraordinary extent. I don't forgive him for what he did to my people, that's for sure. But he probably hasn't hurt us overall. It did in the beginning. Two of my daughters wouldn't speak to me for months after I came public. But
I think that's resonated with a lot of people. Is a lot of people had issues with, even just within their families, between like their parents were at a nursing home and then their kids wouldn't come see them, even though the parents wanted them to come, or vice versa. Mm. And mates aren't friends anymore based off, you know, every morning with Dan coming out and saying something would be another wedge between two people.
It was terrible. The whole thing. We had a young guy like in IT department who actually committed suicide during one of the lockdowns. And that was, he obviously had depression and stuff, but that pushed him over. Loveliest young guy imaginable. It was absolutely, the girls in the office were crying. They were so upset about it. It was just awful. And he had a great future. We really appreciated him. One thing I didn't realize at the time is that he was concerned his 6 months, you know, to become permanent coming up, and he was going to be through in spades, but I didn't tell him that. And I just wish I had. But if it hadn't been for that lockdown, he'd still be alive. That was the factor, because he was working from home. He was in his bedroom. He wasn't around the office. He didn't have the social. We've got a social stuff. We have staff lunches and all kinds of things, and games nights and, you know, all kinds of stuff that goes on to help people feel part of a family when they're at work. And he didn't have any of that. So it was so sad. I know so many people suffered. I knew two people personally, amongst my franchisees, who lost their marriages and their homes because of lockdowns. It was really, really hard. And I had people being faced with eviction from homes, and you know, other franchises were helping them out, giving them food vouchers and stuff. It was a very hard time.
As the boss of Jim's Bowling, were people just calling out to you for help? Like, what is it that they thought you might be able to do for them? Or were they just desperate and just trying to get onto you for anything?
Well, they appreciated the cause that I was fighting for them. I would put everything into it. So certainly that gave us some credibility. But people would ring me up and just say, Jim, what can I do? When's this going to stop? When can we go back to work? And I just said, look, I don't know. We're doing everything we possibly can. We are pushing as hard as we possibly can to try and get this situation resolved and let you get back to work. But what can I do?
Yeah.
It was very hard. I wasn't sitting in an office in Spring Street like the Premier with legions of people around me protecting me from the public. I was actually listening to people, because every franchisee in Jim's Group has my direct phone number and email address. This is a policy from way back. So they would contact me directly and talk about what was going on. It wasn't bad for us financially, because we still grew during that period, but it was terrible emotionally. And I felt the pain. You know, we had one girl who was faced with eviction. I said, if you get evicted, come and stay at the conference center. You know, we won't charge you. Mm. It was very bad. But she wasn't. She's done brilliantly since then, but very hard time.
I've spoken to some bar and restaurant owners, and they had a lot of backpackers and stuff that came through, and they weren't getting any of the benefits that obviously Australians were. Mm. And then we're not being able to work, they couldn't pay for a place to stay. And so I understand how it works with the people that work for you end up being pretty much a family, which is why we sort of went with small business / family owned business, because a lot of people that have like 5 employees, or I mean like yourself, you've got obviously thousands, but the smaller it is, the more of a tight-knit family it is, especially for startups when a lot of people are making sacrifices anyway and they're not getting paid for the first year. But I feel for anybody who tried to start a business in 2020 thinking that was going to be a good thing for them, because that's obviously gone very, very badly for them. And I just don't know what handouts they'll end up getting. When you were talking about the suicide, the average age of death is what, 82? And the average age of people dying of COVID was 84. Mm. And in general, the suicides I used to go to in my old job were sort of 40 to 50 males after a breakup, whereas we had people 12 trying to hang themselves. I'd never heard of that before. And although apparently the suicide rate didn't go up, the age of people doing it had dropped drastically. So that was, there's a lot of unseen things that weren't really getting looked at.
I was very surprised at that. You have to believe the statistics, I guess, but the amount of hurt I saw, certainly people with psychological problems and calls to mental health numbers and so forth went up dramatically. We certainly saw the effect in our own group. We're very concerned about public health in mental health at Jim's. It's probably our number one cause. We support Beyond Blue because it's such a widespread problem, and because most of the franchises are men who have a particular vulnerability. So we have enormous stress on things like keeping in contact. We have all kinds of systems, like, for example, we have a free psychologist online for any franchisee to talk to. We have all of our franchisors go through mental health training. We send out fridge magnets with all the different mental health numbers. We have volunteer mentors amongst our franchisees. So we're very aware of these kinds of issues, and we could see during COVID how dramatically worse things became, and how people were hurting so badly. And the trouble is that you focus so much on physical health, on what's supposed to get about bring back physical health, but you ignore mental health at your peril. Because you know the number one danger facing our franchisees. Now, our franchisees, they do trees, they work tens of meters in the air. They work with chainsaws, with mowers, which has fast-spinning blades, with poisonous chemicals, all this stuff. They also do a lot of driving, so they've got emphasis. You know what the number one cause of death amongst franchisees is? Suicide. And in the whole history of Jim's Group, only one person has ever died from an accident, which was a chainsaw accident. But several have died from suicide. So mental health is important, and I really wish that when you think about things like lockdowns and what you can do to the economy, you actually consider the mental health of the population, not just a narrow version of what their physical health, because mental health problems lead to physical health problems.
Yeah. I think when they shut all the gyms down as well, a lot of people used to use gym as an outlet, for, which is, you know, I mean, it's been shown that the more physically active you are, the better you are at dealing with stress, releasing endorphins and all that sort of thing. That's what I was going to say. Since the lockdowns and people coming to you, do you think what happened with mandates with you? Like, did you have any interaction with the government that you were going to get in trouble if you were just going to let people go out and work, or how did that work?
Well, apparently after my first reaction, the police commissioner gave an order. He said, focus on gyms mowing franchisees. He told the police to actually go after us, to specifically go after us, as a kind of revenge, I suppose, for me having go at the Premier, which was a pretty nasty thing to do. I have to say, though, the Vic police were fantastic. They were just a great bunch of men and women. I had the utmost respect for them. And they really did what they did with grace and with courtesy. And you could not fault them. They did their best in a very difficult situation, and they were fantastic. But certainly from what the state government tried to do, in a sense, politicize the police was you know, one more appalling act in their litany of horrors.
So overall, like after speaking out and voicing an opinion, have you got more of a positive or a negative from that? Like, what's it cost you versus what you've gained?
Well, the worst cost was personal, like I said, in my own family. And it was, you know, one of those relationships wasn't really healed for years. It was very hard. It's fine now. I get on well with her now. But that was the emotional hurt at the time was pretty awful. But on the whole, like I said, it's been a positive to us because it's raised our profile. I get people, like the other day I was just in the car park, and this independent mine contractor came up and just thanked me and congratulated me. He just said, thank you for what you did because you stood up for us. And I get that quite a lot. So it's overall, it's actually been beneficial. I think in the end, at the beginning, people were just panic stricken and crazy and just do whatever, you know, beloved Chairman Dan, I'll just bow and obey. But with time, they came to see things like the council gardens got them really upset. Like, people were always sending me pictures of council gardens working in groups. And they said, this is so crazy, this stage that they've taken, that they can work in group, but your people can't work individually. And people thought it was unfair. So I think in the end, even most of the left-leaning, we were about probably a 90% that were pretty much agreed with what I said. Which is very good too, because this won't be the last lockdown we ever come through. So in the future, the government may not take small business with such cavalier indifference as they did. You know, it's very interesting in talking about the way the governments think about it. The what happened originally, I don't know if you know, but the Department of Health and Human Services put out guidelines that specifically allowed for sole operators working alone without any contact with the public or each other. Okay, that was specifically allowed in the government. We looked at them very carefully. That came out on like the Saturday. The following, I think it was the Wednesday, the Premier got up at a press conference and said, you can no longer get your lawns mowed or your houses cleaned. That was the change. It wasn't the Department of Health. They did a very detailed, carefully multi-page thing to reduce infection. And the Premier just went out and put a fist right through the whole thing and made his own idea. Now, that was the change. We actually have gone to court to ask for the evidence that they had to make that change, and there hasn't been anything. The government's come back through the VCAT to say, we don't have to give you the evidence. You know, we had good evidence, but we don't have to tell you what it was. We are not obliged to tell you any reason why we shut down the state in that way. We shut down sole operators. But what's also interesting about that thing is the phrasing that he used. He didn't say, look, you small business owners can't go out and do your work. You can't clean houses. You can't mow lawns. What he says is you can't get your lawns mowed or your houses cleaned. So who's he speaking to? Not the small operators. He's speaking to his people, which is the urban elites, the left wing, the woke brigade, that sort of the civil servants, the lawyers, the accountants, the people that tend to support him. the important people, not the dregs of society, not the people who mow the lawns and build fences. They're not, they're beneath contempt. I don't care about them. I don't think about them. My constituency is the important people, which is the elites, the professionals, and the unions. They're the people that matter to me. And that particular phrasing said more about his attitude than anything he ever did.
Yeah, right. Oh, another thing I was wondering was, did you have many of your franchisees, did they move into state? You've obviously got franchises around Australia. I was wondering, did many of them pick up and move from Victoria to another region?
No.
No?
Nor did I. I would think that there's other states that are far more favourable to business, especially to small business, than Victoria. But, you know, you can't move. You've got your clients here. You've got your staff here.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody who moved interstate.
I had a bunch of friends who left when the mandates came in, and they went up north and went to Queensland.
These days, when you can work remotely, it's different. I mean, it has changed the world a lot. We've got people answering the phones for us in Perth, which is great because the timescale means that they can answer calls late at night in a way that we don't have to have staff sticking around until late at night in our Melbourne office. So a lot of people, you found a lot of people work extremely well. Certain kinds of meetings work well, very well. But actually, we also find that the personal interaction is very important too. So you actually generate more and better ideas when you chat informally with people. So it's we've learned a lot about remote working. The COVID wasn't 100% negative in every way. Overall, it was pretty nasty and caused a lot of suffering, but we learned a lot.
Yeah. You were mentioning VCAT before. Are you still going through court cases and stuff with the government, or is that all done and dusted now?
Oh, no. We took a case to VCAT. Basically, we asked, in effect, what was your reasons? Because the government's own law, which is back in 2008, this is passed by the Andrews government, said that nobody should be deprived of their livelihood without good reason. Okay, so we took a test case, one of my franchisees, we took the court to VCAT to say, okay, he was deprived of his livelihood, what was the reason? And the state government argued, well, we don't have to give you the reason. We had a good reason, but we don't have to tell you the reason. And VCAT agreed with him. They said, no, you don't have to tell them the reason. You don't. That was their reply. Now, that is not particularly surprising, because basically VCAT is a hireling of the state government. They're appointed by the state government. They're at their mercy, promotions, everything. They'll do whatever Andrew said. It's not an independent court in any sense. So what we've now done is we're appealing to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is a serious court. And we're fairly confident that they will see this argument for the nonsense that it is. If the law says you can't be deprived of your livelihood without good reason, if the government deprives you of a livelihood, it's fairly reasonable to say, well, show us the reason, which of course they don't have any reason, because they don't have any reason for doing this. It was purely politics. So, no, I'm confident in the end we will actually do it. And the nice thing about it, of course, it's a gift that keeps on giving, because every time we get some sort of a decision, even a negative one, it's more publicity and more pressure on the government. And really, the biggest thing that we're after here, I mean, more than the defeat of the Andrews government, though I dearly like to see them out, that's for sure, is it's going to make it very difficult to do the same thing again. They can't ignore small business in the way that they did back in 2020 and 2021.
I think it's interesting that, I don't know that people are aware, we're still under a state of emergency powers at the moment. So realistically, he could do exactly what he's done before and come out in the radio this morning at midday and then just go, as of midnight, we're locked down again.
It was a very frightening experience in a way too. You look at the difference. How is the state of Victoria different from somewhere like Russia or China? Well, in a sense, I mean, it's elected dictatorship. The premier's there. He's got control of both houses of parliament. He controls the executive. He can decide basically any powers. He can stop you from moving, do all kinds of things, stop you doing anything he wants. That's pretty powerful. There's only one difference between what happened in Victoria during COVID and what happened in China or in Russia is that here we've got a free press. So there's an element of the press, which is basically, I'd have the Murdoch papers and Sky News and so forth, were able to actually speak out and have a say, and people could express themselves. That's the only difference. In terms of the actual structure of government, our governments have the same power as Xi Jinping does in China.
I think the media was, I mean, it took them a while to get on board before they started saying anything. They obviously had to wait for a few fringe groups, for example, to start saying enough stuff to make enough noise before they'd actually show any sort of interest. When was the first time you saw the Murdoch media or whoever it was actually show an interest in what you were saying and helping you out? Because I dare say you didn't just say something the first time and then everybody jumped over.
No, we got a good response, actually. I've got a PR lady who's a fantastic lady who does, and I sent an open letters to the media, and we got good response. And we had a lot of direct contacts with people in News Corp and so forth. So they got the photographers and stuff. So if you did the cameras, used to come out for sunrise and stuff. We knew each other. We were always best mates, kind of thing, discussing the world and what's going on. And so we had great relationships. I have to say too, one thing. I'm not a rusted on a liberal supporter. I'm actually a little bit centre of the road. I think the Albanese government's doing a pretty fair job, as a matter of fact. I'd make a distinction between a state and a Labor government. In fact, some of the Labor policies, like being more in favour of controlling greenhouse emissions and a bit more redistribution, I think it's actually pretty good. But the state government's very different. The state government in Victoria is really, really extreme, left-wing, incompetent, just callous, indifferent to the real welfare of people in the society. They're a really nasty government. And I have to say it. And it's not because it's the party, it's the people who lead it.
Were you surprised with how much power the state had? Because that was a real eye-opener for me. I assumed that the federal government would have power over the states, but then everything that affected my life had nothing to do with the federal government.
I was shocked and appalled by the whole thing. I just couldn't believe how much power the government had, but also that how spineless Victorians were about the whole thing. I mean, this worship of the premier, you know, he's almighty. He just does what we do, whatever he says, and we're friends of Dan, this kind of thing. And that was just extraordinary. You know, in the past, Australians were, I mean, we were a really individualistic people. There's a wonderful story about the place in the siege of Tobruk, where there was this British officer who was dressed in a really immaculate uniform with shiny shoes, and he came across this digger digging with his shirt off in a ditch, and this guy didn't salute him, and he got very annoyed and started telling him off. So this guy got out of the ditch, went over, picked up his shirt, and he was a major. This was a captain, and he was a major, and then he returned the salute, and then he said, "Listen, I'm the COO here. I'm the commanding officer here, and my men don't even salute me. So piss off." That kind of irreverence for authority was just an amazing part of our character, and it was so great. You know, I mean, it's a wonderful book, actually, about your book. I forget the name of it. It does all these great books. But there was a case where the trains had left Tobruk, but there was an Australian, and they were trying to get some of the Germans to surrender. And this guy said, "Well, I'm Australian." He said, "Oh, don't tell me that. You're just trying to frighten me, because the trains are so feared as being such great soldiers." I mean, we were like that. We were larrikins, but we were really independent people, and you could not push us around. What happened to Victoria during COVID, and Australia in general, I suppose, but particularly in Victoria? That spineless weakness is just pathetic.
I think it's been happening for a while with society and values, and things have been moving across the board. But it wasn't really until the pandemic came that we sort of showed how far it'd gone, I think.
The state government, you don't worry about too. And most of the things the state government does, we're pretty happy with. They run the police force. And as I said, we've got a great police force in Victoria. So most things tend to run pretty well most of the time. It's only when if the government wastes a few tens of millions of dollars on diversity consultants, I suppose it doesn't really affect me that much. But it's only when the emergency hits that the true value of a government you know, comes out. I mean, I would never, I actually ran some fundraisers for the federal Liberal Party at one stage, but I've never run them for the state party because I've never seen any important issues involved. But, you know, better now.
It was funny growing up, like my old man and mum were always saying that the politicians were all a bunch of crooks, and then you'd never trust them for anything. And then as soon as the pandemic happened, all of a sudden they were to be, you know, they were the be all and end all and not to be questioned. And yeah. I was like, I don't know when that happened. But
well, we get the government we deserve, don't we? I think governments reflect people. We had pretty good governments in Australia for quite a long time, as federal governments, you know, Hawke, Keating and Howard, great leaders, visionary leaders, people who prepared to take steps for the good of the country, not necessarily do what was popular, do what was right, look to the long term. We had some pretty good leadership for a while. And I think people supported them to that extent. And I think the fact that more recent governments have been a lot less impressive is a reflection of declining character of the Australian population, which I think was showed during COVID. I was disappointed. I really was. The way people just worshipped the government and just did whatever they said and didn't question, didn't even think of the sense of it. Especially in the beginning. I think with time, people became a bit more wise, a bit more critical about you know, the kind of things we went through.
I think a lot of it's come from community as well. Like, you don't see as many kids playing community sport anymore. There's not as many teams. There's, you know, I mean, you used to have church and that was a bigger deal back then. But anywhere that people used to congregate and come together and actually and talk and things, whereas now everything's online. Everyone's just throwing random comments on Twitter or Facebook or whatever other social media it is you want to get to a point where it's now down to, I don't know, like Instagram would rather you do a 15-second piece rather than, you know, read a book like people used to do back in the day. I think it's a society as a whole thing that's led to where we are now. So hopefully we don't have to reach rock bottom before we try and turn things around. But
you're right. There's a lot less sense of community, and that applies to churches. It applies to membership of political parties. It even applies to membership of unions. Union membership's gone way down, except in the public sector. People just don't work together as much. And I think a lot of our problems with mental illness reflect that too. You know, just the fact that people don't see each other. I mean, that's one thing in my own life. I've actually been making more of an effort lately just to get together with like-minded people. And you know, we have games nights and we go out to dinner at restaurants and stuff. I do a lot more of that than I used to. And because you're understanding how important that is to mental health and well-being and life satisfaction. We need to get back there, get offline. You know, these things are wonderful, but they're, I love mine, but I never engage in social media. I post, somebody else posts for me on social media, but I don't personally engage in it. I really rather talk to people directly, face to face, as far as possible.
Yeah, definitely. Can I ask you a question? Why are you Jim's mowing and not Dave's mowing?
Oh, well, when I left school in 1969, I went to work on a farm, and there was a young guy there about my age called David. So I said, I'll call you by my second name, Jim. So it started there. It's kind of a way of breaking free from the childhood and stuff. It's a bit more, Jim's a bit more macho. It's a bit more, you know. I don't know. But here's my second name, David James. But David is very, very civilized, very polite, and Jim is a bit more rough and tough in Australia and stuff like that.
Yeah, have you seen a lot of other Jim's logos being used for stuff that you're not doing, like
Jim's car racing
and Jim's it's everything else?
It's a great thing actually. We do it ourselves. We're actually launching a whole lot of. We've got Jim's hitmen and Jim's pirates and all sorts of things. We actually do our own little stuff. It's really fun. I mean, it's all over the place. It's amazing. It's become a particularly among youth, for example, for some reason. I'd say 15 to 25 is our top demographic, especially girls. So how do you make that? I don't understand it really, but it's become very, very, very trendy. It's all over the place. I mean, I love it. It's really fun. It's really fun. You have little kids actually who just like this little boy who's quite strongly autistic, and he. He's a huge Jim's fan. He loves anything to do with Jim's. So we actually brought him to the office and said, come to, because he's in Victoria, and he said, come to the office. And we showed him around and then, you know, got to mow a lawn with him and this kind of stuff too. It was really fun. So you get that kind of engagement. But I did another one for engineering for kids where I actually spoke to a classroom of children, but like 8-year-olds online, and just interacted with their questions. I like that kind of stuff. I really like kids. I've got 10 of my own, so I don't mind them. But it's, what do you, it's a lot of fun.
What are you looking at breaking into next? Have you got, because you've got like Jim's decking, you've Jim's mowing, Jim's window cleaning, Jim's car wash. Is there any other new things you're going to jump into?
We'd like to get Jim's driving school off the ground. That's a good one too.
Oh, really?
Demographic. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. The driving school, the people that have like the RACV, they charge a fortune to the people who are doing it. Our franchise fees average about 6%, so it's very small by comparison. So somebody can make a much better income. So we think we can attract people from that. So we just need someone to drive it. But look, there's many divisions. We're looking for someone to start gyms, get gyms paving off the ground. And there's a number of divisions that are small that need leadership. We're always looking for leaders.
We have a very
indirect system. We have a lot of franchisors and divisional franchisors who take leadership in certain areas. Gyms is not as centrally controlled. It's why when you talk about being one of Australia's biggest companies, we're actually by far the biggest franchise network. But income wise, we're probably turning over, you know, close to $1 billion a year, but only a fairly small fraction that comes back to my pockets. It's very indirect. Most of it goes to the franchisees, and most of what they get goes to the franchisors who look after them directly, and then we get sort of a little bit left over. So, I mean, which is, you know, I'm pretty well off, obviously, but still, I think that's why you grow so much
when you actually look after your employees, they stay. I mean, there's a reason you keep growing. You're looking at getting into Jim's Angry Victorians and get a bunch of politicians growing for you.
I don't know. People are always saying Jim for PM, but I'd make a terrible politician, Chris. I really would. I just say what I think, and that's, you can't do that in politics. You cannot do that in politics. Maybe in your case, being an upper house, I don't know how it works, but in general, it's a very skilled profession, and I have to say that I'm not contentious with politicians in general. I think many of them are very fine men and women. They really, really care about what they do, and as I said, we've had some very, very good leaders, great leaders in Australia. But you can't say anything wrong. You've got people following you all the time, listening to every word you say. And if you say one phrase that could be interpreted the wrong way, you are dead. That's a really, really hard thing to do. I could not do it. I say wrong things all the time. I say stupid things all the time. If you were trying to get me elected, they could just point out some dumb thing that Jim said. No, I'd be hopeless. I really would.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are seeing with like podcasts and things, where if you say something that could be misconstrued, you get a chance to explain why that is. Whereas when you're looking at your Herald Sun or The Age, where all they can do is have it one line that's going to suck people in, and they obviously have a massive headline with something that you've said, and then if people bother reading it, which a lot of people don't, they just see the headline and go, oh, that's, take it as gospel. And then, I mean, they might clarify it in the interview afterwards, but same as on screen TV with the mainstream there, where they've got a 5-second soundbite they can use, all they're going to go is a statement from that, and then that'll go viral online. So I think that's another thing that's happened with the media now, where it's not about being correct anymore; it's just about being first. I think we've lost a lot of things.
Look, the media's got to grab your attention, and I have enormous respect and appreciation for the media. As I said, they were the ones that protected us during COVID. They stood up for ordinary citizens in a way that the governments, but the Victorian government didn't. But they've got to try and grab people in. They've got to get people's attention. And sometimes, you know, the gaffe, the mistake is exactly how they do that. And I guess it's just their profession, their job. But I mean, they're very fine people, actually. I think I had contact with quite a few during the lockdown, and they were great people. They really cared about what they did, and they cared about their profession. And they were very, very competent about how they went about it. It wasn't negative overall, but you know, you got to understand. I mean, look, you got to also be careful too. One of the problems I got to in the epidemic, when I did my first interview with Channel 7, I made a point. I said that, listen, what the Premier said isn't the law. The law is the Department of Health and Human Services. So the actual law says that you can go out and you can do these jobs, regardless of what the Premier says. And they said, well, what happens if you get fined? And I said, well, you won't get fined, but if they do get fined, I'll pay the fine. Now, so what I was saying was, you can do these things because we're obeying the law. But what they did is they edit the conversation down. They made it seem as though I was asking people to defy the law. Yeah. So I learned from that particular experience. That was the particular thing that got me in trouble with my daughters. I've learned from that is you've got to be very careful what you say. You can't separate two bits of information. You can't separate this is not the law and we won't, and we therefore we'll do this stuff. You've got to put them together in one sentence. So ever since then, if it's a live interview, I'm very careful to put it together. I was interviewed by A Current Affair just recently, and I actually had one of my people videoing the whole interview so that if they misinterpreted it, then we could actually release on social media what I actually said. As it happened, that we didn't need to, because they actually did do a very fair treatment. And I think Current Affair is, again, it's a fine program too. I think they do some great things. But all the same, you've got to understand where they're coming from and the fact that they're trying to get a news story out. I think one of the reasons I did well during COVID is because I'm fairly outspoken. I give a blast at the government in a way that possibly, you know, some other people couldn't. Maybe they were more constrained, but I was very furious, and that came across quite well in that environment. But still wouldn't make a good politician.
The way I've had it explained was when you go on the media, they'll give you a stick and they just want to see how hard you whack something. It's pretty much,
of course. I mean, the harder you whack it, the more likely you are to come back. You can get attention from the media, but you've got to understand what they want. They want story, they want passion, they want life. You've got to be a, you know, I did a lot of with his books behind me in this office. I did a lot of interviews like that too, which is just, it was an interesting experience. It was very, very big learning curve, the whole thing.
I've let a lot of media down, I think, when they go to speak to me and they expect me to just go on a rant every time because we're the angry Victorians. But they're like, "What? Why are you so placid?" I'm like, "Well, it's sort of like when you call a bloke tiny and he's 7 foot tall." Because it's sort of the other way around. But I was very angry.
Chris, I don't know if you call yourself angry Victorians. Maybe you should practice the acting skills and get a bit more angry about it. Because I mean, if you think about it, there's enough things to get angry about, isn't there? I mean, was appalling. It really, really was appalling. And I was furious at the time about what they did because I felt the hurt that they caused and the damage they caused. And I'm still annoyed. I can't say I personally hate Andrews or anything. I wouldn't be rejoiced to see him assassinated or something like that. But I just use that line.
I want to see him assassinated. We'll use that.
No, I said I wouldn't want to see him assassinated. But if you actually said something like that, if you said that you would, then you could be in that could be taken. And look, it'd be a wrong thing to say too. I do believe in democratic politics. Even if people elect a government that I don't agree with, even if they do make what I believe would be a tragic mistake in November and re-elect the Andrews government, I'll still respect that. I think the most dangerous thing is when you don't respect elections, like what happened with when Trump lost in America. And there's tens of millions of Americans don't accept that verdict. That is a really, really, really worrying situation. We've got to accept that we won't always win. The side we want won't always get in, but you must respect the electoral system and the democracy, even if it means the other side's doing things you don't necessarily approve of. I would not favour Andrews being removed by a coup. Now, that obviously that's pretty obvious, but the fact is, no matter how much you dislike of what he's done, I would not want to subvert the democratic process.
What would you like to see ideally in November, though? Like, would you like to see a majority government down the bottom or a minority and then a completely different government up in the upper house?
Oh, I'd like to see the Liberals get in. And Liberals, Nationals get in, of course, in Victoria. As I said, I'm quite different at the national level. I think Albanese is a good man, and I think he's leading a good government.
Yeah.
But in terms of Victoria, I think a Liberal government would be far better for the state. I greatly admired Jeff Kennett. He did some really, really great things. He was a great reforming premier. And I think one of the reasons he only lasted two terms is because he was probably pushed too hard. But in terms of things like, you know, cutting costs and improving administration, he was a great man. He's a very admirable man.
Do you think the Liberals are still sort of resting on Jeff Kennett a fair bit? But everybody that I spoke to, like the last good Liberal leader that they tell me about is Jeff Kennett. And it's like, well, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. And it's sad. We've not had leadership in this state at that level ever since. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not one little bit. It's very disappointing. I'm disappointed that the state government, Liberal opposition can't do a better job. They seem to be, I don't know. They just don't have a loud voice. I know when I was doing fundraisers when Tony Abbott was the opposition leader, and the kind of job he did in opposition was fantastic. He was a great opposition leader, not such a successful prime minister, but he really hammered the point. He was really good with the media. He knew what to say and how to say. I actually saw him being interviewed by the media and how he responded. He was very, very good at that. And you know, people like Bob Hawke, he was fantastic in when he first became, he was a great campaigner too. So you have people on both sides of politics who are very, very good at campaigning. Liberals don't seem to have that. Now, what they'd be like in government, the last government we had, the Liberal government, was the Baillieu government, and they were weak as water. They really were. I mean, you couldn't tell the difference. Mm. How could you believe in a government that didn't seem to believe in itself? I don't know what they stood for. I didn't even know what they were after.
Yeah. Have you been involved in any fundraising or anything like that for like the Labor or Liberal parties at all, or any other minor parties?
No. I probably I may do a fundraiser for Liberals with the state party. If they ask me, I'm just thinking maybe contacting some of my contacts and say if you wanted to, because we've got a conference center, we just run things for them.
Yeah,
because state politics is so important. I mean, I'm not optimistic. The opinion polls seem to show that once again we're going to be elected to Andrews, which just it depresses me. But so if I can do a little bit to try and push it in the right direction. And again, it's not because I'm a Liberal stalwart. I'm certainly not. I just think we need a better state government.
Is there with the Liberal fundraising stuff, have you ever thought about getting around other minor parties, or if you're not affiliated with any of them for a reason, or?
Never had any contact with them. Honestly, I mean, I don't know anybody. I know. The trouble is, I'm not going to be think difficult for you, I don't know, but I do believe in the party system.
And because in the two-party system.
You know what a person stands for if they're part of an organised political party, whether it's Labor or Liberal or Greens. I mean, Greens are horrible. I hate the Greens. But you have an idea what you're voting for. One of the examples of why it's so difficult if you don't comes to local politics. Now, we're in the Yarra Ranges Shire over here, and it's probably the single worst local government in the state. They are so incompetent. Their policies are so stupid. Their planning laws are so labyrinth. And it took us years to do the most simple things in getting permission to do stuff on our site here in our conference center. You know, we spent about 3 years trying to get a sporting complex, which is so beneficial. There's no disadvantages. And there wasn't nobody objected. Nobody said no, but just the planning process was labyrinth and they were horrible. Now, the problem with that is that there's no way to actually elect a better local council because there's no political parties, so you don't know what anybody stands for. All you can do is look at their speeches and try and figure out what they might actually do. But there's no, they're not held to anything. You understand that if you're voting Labour on the whole, you're voting for, you know, higher taxes and more redistribution and stuff and maybe more action on greenhouse gases. If you're voting for Liberal, it's more for small business and lower taxes. It's kind of stuff. You have some sort of idea what a party stands for. When it comes to individuals, you don't. Now, obviously you're angry Victorian. We have a pretty good sense. You're not a love child of the Premier, but I'd have a fairly good idea if I was voting for you. I would vote for somebody who wasn't going to be his best friend in politics. But all the same, it's very difficult when you step outside of standard political parties without, yeah.
It was interesting when we had the federal that we went for with the Australian Values Party, and the votes that came back, we had 150,000 were primary voters were Liberal, and then 130,000 primary voters were Labor. So we were, it's sort of, which is where we were hoping to be because we're very centralised. But it's interesting to see when the stats come back and where they come from, and even just having a name, Australian Values didn't seem to resonate with any of the media. They didn't really want to speak to us, whereas Angry Victorians achieves a lot more cut through than just from a name. They don't, it's irrelevant.
But Chris, you do need to sound a bit more angry. really from a political point of view, if you use that name, I really think you need some passion building. This is why we need a better government, because this is so bad. What happened? You've got to get that carry through. Look, the lovely thing about Australian politics, and Australian politics is political system, it's pretty good by world standards. I mean, if you look at our with the American system, that's a shocker. That really is dysfunctional to the extreme. But one of the good things about our system is you can do preferential voting. So in other words, if you have a party that you really like the sound of, you might think that Angry Victorian sounds like my number one. So I'll put my number one for that, but I'll put my number two for whichever party I want, Liberal or whatever. probably not Labor, given your viewpoint. But the point of it is you can still have a voice for the major party. You don't throw your vote away if you vote for somebody minor, which is the case in most electorates, like in the UK, where you know, you have one vote and that's it. So it's actually a good situation, really, for minor parties to get a bit more of a say and to have a bit of a niche. And sometimes they're interesting too. I mean, you get something like Clive Palmer, and we're talking federal politics, where he's put, you know, billions of dollars in and got himself one MP elected, which is pretty pathetic. But Palmer is, as far as I can tell, is a voice for himself, the Australian United Party. It's his own interest, his own business interest seems to be what he's primarily after. He's trying to buy himself a seat at the table in politics. Well, that's my impression. Maybe I'm wrong, but
the preferential system in Victoria is a little bit different, though. The upper house, you've got the group voting ticket. So as soon as you put a one next to one party, it's whatever they decide is sort of where it goes. I think we're the only state that still do that. So I don't know if we can change that going forward. But with the federal one, it's like the preference system 1-6 of where you want to put people. I think that's been good, and it needs to be pointed out a bit more. I think that Victoria is the only one.
But then again, so when you're saying in Victoria it happens that you, if he votes number one for Angry Victorians, then in effect you set the preferences.
Yep.
But there's nothing wrong with that actually, because you're still able to put number one vote for you, but still able to presumably vote for people that are politically similar. That's not a bad idea, really. I don't mind that at all. I often do that in federal politics when you're voting for the Senate. I will actually decide which party I want overall to get in, whether it's Labor or Liberal. Usually Liberal, but sometimes Labor. But I don't mind following the party line. I'll just take one and then just follow their preferences, whatever they are.
Yeah.
So you can. It's a good system, actually. We've got a lot of good things in Australia. I think compulsory voting is a good system too, because if you let people to volunteer to vote, well then you tend to disenfranchise those who are less powerful in society. So it gives more of a voice to the voiceless, which I think is a very positive thing. If anything, the big problem with our society is that there's too much inequality. You know, the rich are getting richer and the poor aren't not doing particularly well, or at least the middle aren't doing particularly well.
But that was the thing. I saw a report on the middle class is generally where all the wealth is, but now in the last 2 years, that's gone from the middle class to actually being in the elite now. Because before it was like 90% of the wealth was in the middle class, and now it's gone to up to the top, and that's when they reckon things start going pear-shaped.
Yeah, well, look, it's true. I'm obviously in the top, you know, whatever, 1/10 of a percent or whatever, for the income distribution. So, I mean, in part of that elite that is doing particularly well. But I don't think it's a good thing. I would say a wealth distribution more like Scandinavia, which is actually the happiest countries on earth overall. Mm. Inequality also is really bad for society.
They also didn't go with lockdowns and listen to their own doctors.
Well, in Sweden actually had a very hands-off way of doing things and didn't seem to suffer much worse than anyone else. So I think we can learn a lot from certain countries about how to handle things better. But I do think we did well, because the great advantage of Australia is that we're landlocked. We're a continent all to ourselves. We're the only country that's got its own continent. So we could actually block off access in the way, as did, say, New Zealand and Iceland too, I think. So island countries have a big benefit. So I'm not against, I think the way we cut ourselves off from the world was very sensible, but the internal, the way we handled the lockdown certainly wasn't ideal in a lot of ways, especially in Victoria.
All right, Jim, I've taken up a lot of your time. I'll cut it away there. Thanks very much.
Good luck with your campaign, and don't be afraid to sound angry. If you've got a name like that, get out there. You'll get me. You want to be a colourful performer, Chris. You want to actually give them an interest. You want to have good sound bite that they can take. Bearing in mind a longer interview, that'll actually get through in a way. Don't forget the media is in the business of entertainment too. They've got to grab eyeballs. So if you can help them with that, then say a few punchy things and get a bit passionate, and well, all the best to you. We're all working together. We'd all like to see the Andrews government gone. So God bless you, and do your best.
All right. Cheers. Thanks very much, Jim.
All right. See you.